We're going to be talking about the Christian and the arms race. The Christian and the arms race. Now, before we get into it, I would like to begin by defining a few terms, and then we can go on and talk about the issues involved. A lot of people have an awareness of the nuclear arms race that is dismal. In other words, they know basically that both sides can blow up the world, and that's about the extent of their knowledge. I'd like to define a few terms for you, and then we'll talk about how to understand these issues in the light of Christianity. First, an ICBM. An ICBM stands for Intercontinental Ballistic Missile. ICBM. Intercontinental Ballistic Missile. All right? An ABM is an anti-ballistic missile. An ABM is an anti-ballistic missile. An FBM is a type of a submarine, and it's a fleet ballistic missile. In other words, it's a ballistic missile at sea. And an FBM submarine is a submarine that carries ballistic missiles. All right? High yield means it's like a dirty bomb, lots of radiation, big mess. Okay? High yield radiation. Then you have the opposite, low-yield weapons. A cruise missile is a nuclear weapon that, unlike an ICBM, is launched, goes into outer space, and then re-enters and lands. A cruise missile flies like an airplane. Okay, it's got wings, and it can fly under enemy radar. Okay, so a cruise missile is a low-flying weapon. Neutron bomb. A neutron bomb is a weapon that is designed to kill people, but without destroying property, without destroying things. Obviously, at the point of explosion, things are destroyed, but it's designed to have a high-intensity radiation that will kill people, but will leave material intact. Now, a theater nuclear weapon is a weapon that is designed for use on the battlefield. Okay, that's a theater weapon. A neutron bomb is a theater weapon. A lot of people think that the only kind of nuclear weapon you can make is one that will blow up half the continent. You know, that's the only thing you can do. No, that's not true. We are fully capable of making weapons that will not blow up everything in sight and can be used in a limited fashion. All right. Now, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I left undefined. Oh, mutual assured destruction, MAD, okay, is our current nuclear strategy. Mutual assured destruction is our current nuclear strategy. SALT, SALT 1 and 2, the SALT stands for Strategic Arms Limitation Talks. Strategic Arms Limitation Talks 1 and 2. President Reagan has been advocating START talks, strategic arms reduction talks. START talks. We have not had any START talks. They haven't started. We've had two SALT treaties. SALT 1 was ratified. SALT 2 was concluded by President Carter, but then not ratified by the U.S. Senate. All right? So SALT 2 is not in effect. Now, the current situation between the two superpowers is this. Both sides have offensive nuclear capacity. That is, we've got ICBMs and fleet ballistic missiles. Neither side has an ABM system. Okay? Neither side has an ABM system. We do not have an ABM system because SALT 1 negotiated ABMs out of existence. In other words, both sides agreed not to develop a defensive capacity. Now, an ABM system can operate different ways. If they launch their missiles, you could have an ABM missile system that would launch missiles designed to knock their missiles out of the sky. In other words, you don't shoot missiles at them back, you shoot missiles at their missiles and take them out. Right? You may have seen recently a test of that nature. It wasn't an explosion that took the missile out, but there's a they had a thing that went up and just collided with the missile and destroyed it. President Reagan advocated, I think it was a couple of years ago, his famous Star Wars system, which was not an ABM system conducted by missiles. It wasn't anti-missile missiles. It was anti-missile particle beams and lasers, a satellite system where the satellites would take out the missiles. All right. Now, both of those are an ABM system. They're an anti-ballistic missile system designed to take the missiles out. Currently, neither side has a defensive capacity. All right. Now, this goes back to mutual assured destruction. This strategy says that we will avoid war by making war unthinkable. All right. We will avoid war so that the Soviets will not launch an attack against us, knowing that if they did, we would have enough time before their missiles hit to launch ours, and it would just blow up the world, and nobody's going to, that doesn't make any sense for anybody to do. So they're not going to do that. It is a strategy that rests completely on deterrence. So if the Soviets launched a missile attack against us, there is nothing we could do about the incoming missiles. Right? Absolutely nothing we can do. Once the missiles were launched, you could not defend the American people. The only thing you could do would be avenge them and do so quickly before you get hit. Right, now, think about this for a minute. Mutual assured destruction has worked so far. In other words, we've not had a confrontation because we've had confrontations, but we've not had a nuclear conflict because neither side wants to risk what's going to happen to them. Mutual assured destruction only works so long as the other side believes that you would retaliate. Okay, but put yourself in the position of the President of the United States. They have launched an attack, and you know that it's coming in. There's nothing you can do about it. Whether you launch or don't launch isn't going to change what happens to you or happens to the country. Deterrence has failed. What's the sense in killing millions and millions of Russians? There's just no sense in it. You're avenging yourself. You'd be acting in spite and malice and hatred instead of doing something rationally. The purpose is to deter war, and if you get in a war, to win one. Your objective, from a Christian perspective, should never be to destroy everything. That doesn't have any sense to it. Okay? Here's another, let me give you a couple other terms you might run into. First strike and first use. There's a difference between first strike and first use. First strike means attacking the enemy with an all-out nuclear attack. It's an all-out nuclear surprise attack. That's first strike. An all-out nuclear surprise attack is first strike. First use, well, let me give you a scenario. If the President of the United States says, well, let's surprise the Russians, you know, and push the button, and we went to war, that would be first strike. If we threw everything we had at them with no provocation, that'd be first strike. Or if they threw everything at us with no provocation, that'd be first strike. Scenario number two, first use. Suppose the Soviets invaded Western Europe conventionally. Okay, in other words, no nuclear weapons at all. They just sent their tanks across the border, okay, and launched a war, a conventional war, and our troops fought back conventionally, but we were way outnumbered, right, and we're pushed back, and West Germany looked like it was going to fall. Okay, we have a number of nuclear weapons in Europe, the Pershings, for example. We have our whole NATO strategy defense of Western Europe depends upon the threat of first use on our part. In other words, we would have pledged ourselves to use nuclear weapons if attacked conventionally, but the weapons we would use would be limited theater weapons. All right. In other words, we would use nuclear weapons first in response to a conventional attack, and we would use them in a limited sense on the battlefield. That's what first use means. First strike means an all-out sneak attack. All right. Now, this ties in with the neutron bomb, which we do not have. The neutron bomb was stopped, but the whole point of the neutron bomb was to enhance our ability for first use. The neutron bomb was, as I've mentioned, it was the bomb that would kill people without destroying the whole country. You know, it would, and it was designed to be used as an anti-tank weapon. In other words, it was a weapon that had a very precise use. All right, so the neutron bomb was a limited theater nuclear weapon designed for use against tanks. Right, now, the anti-nuclear crowd opposes limited, fine-tuned nuclear weaponry for this reason. They say once you use a nuclear weapon on the battlefield, no matter how small it is, there's the danger of escalation to the big boys. So they oppose the development of limited nuclear weapons and just stay with the big boys because their nuclear war is unthinkable. You see what I'm how their argument goes? If both sides have ballistic missiles with these huge, huge explosive capacity, nuclear war is unthinkable for both sides. But if we had a weapon that we could use against a tank division and take out the whole tank division, and it wouldn't harm the countryside, it wouldn't, you know, wouldn't kill everybody in Europe if we did it, using that kind of weapon is thinkable. You can why not? Right. And they say, but once you do that, you've opened the door to a nuclear exchange, and you're going to escalate up, and we will have an all-out nuclear confrontation. Now, I alluded to this last week. I believe the concept of mutual assured destruction, which is our current nuclear strategy, is not defensible morally. Okay, because it depends upon avenging. It depends upon vengeance. Rather than deterring, rather than winning the war. You're not winning any objective. You're just trying to kill people. Okay, I don't think mutual assured destruction can be defended according to the just war theory. Christians, broadly speaking, conservative Christians, fall in the camp where they say it's justifiable to fight in a just war. Obviously, there are some wars that are unjust and a Christian must bow out of. A Christian, for example, would have no business fighting in the war between Iran and Iraq. That whole thing is just stupid. It's based upon hatred and malice, or the fighting between the Hindus and the Sikhs in India. That's just, there's nothing resembling a just cause there. But if there is a just cause, then I must conduct myself honorably in it. Right? Now, if I know that most millions of Americans are going to die, and my only response is to kill millions of Russians who didn't have anything to do with what their government did, what I'm doing is not ethical. It's not moral. Okay? Now, consequently, I am opposed to our current nuclear strategy. I'm opposed to the building of ICBM after ICBM, adding to our nuclear arsenal. I just don't think it makes any sense. All right? Now, that does not mean that I'm opposed to nuclear weaponry. When I was in the Navy, I was on a nuclear fast attack submarine. It was a nuclear powered submarine. We did not have a ballistic missiles on board. We were a smaller boat than the FBMs. We had at least one nuclear weapon. In fact, I used to sleep in the same room with it. And you know, about, I'd say 10, 15 feet away, and I patted you. I have no objection to nuclear weaponry per se. I do have an objection to what you could conceivably do with it. All right, now think about this for a second. Let's go back to the ABM treaty. SALT I abolished or prohibited both sides from developing a defensive capacity. All right, and that locked into place the only deterrence we have is avenging. Right now, there's two ways to deter. If the Soviets are contemplating attacking the United States, we could deter them by saying, if you do that, you blow our head off, we'll blow your head off, which is what we're currently arranged to do. We could say, however, if you launch a first strike at us, we will take out your attack. All right, we'll just blow up your missiles. It's not going to get through. All right. In other words, if you attack us, we aren't saying we will attack you. If you attack us, we will attack your attacking force, the missiles. Now, here's a problem. When you say this, people say, yes, but. If you had an ABM system in place, you're not going to be able to take out all of their weapons. Some will get through. All right? Let's say 40% of their weapons will get through. We take out 60% of their attacking force. Even if that were the case, them attacking would not make sense because they don't know which 40% is going to get through. In other words, a first strike capacity means that you want to attack and you want to take out America's ability to respond. You know, you want to hit military installations, you want to cripple the nation you've attacked. If they take out 60% of your attacking force and you don't know which 60% they're going to take out, you don't know which percentage is going to get through, there's nothing you can count on there. Right? And you don't know if you're going to be able to cripple the United States, then that is a deterrence from attacking. And you are deterring it by saying, we will put up a shield rather than we will attack you back. All right? Now, think about this for a moment. What are the implications for a pacifist who opposes the killing of human beings? Okay, think about this for a second. A strict pacifist is opposed to war, period. Currently, we are pledged to kill millions of Russians if they attack us. That's what we are pledged to do. That's what our whole strategy is based on. Obviously, a pacifist has to object to that. Now, what I'm suggesting is that we shift to a strategy of not attacking people, but attacking inanimate objects, missiles. In other words, could a pacifist, in good conscience, shoot down a piece of metal? Yeah. If he thought it was that simple. Now, if he thought shooting down the piece of metal is going to make the world more unstable and more people will wind up getting killed, then he's got a basis for objecting. But I would argue with him on practical grounds. He couldn't argue with me on theoretical grounds. There's nothing immoral about taking out a hunk of metal.
Well, before we get too deep into this, I had a guy talk this morning about it, and the whole idea behind the canceling of the ABM possibility was the fact that a creation of it was MRRs, multiple reentry vehicles, where you have multiple warheads when there was the possibility of a limited ABM system, multiple warheads, and so if you have a system that's even 99% efficient in destroying missiles, the obvious outcome of that is that the other side builds that many more missiles. And that was what they saw was the problem with it, because their first ABM system, they have MRRs, they have that many more warheads out on the market. And also,
okay, for everybody, a MRRV warhead is a single missile with multiple warheads that will split up. In other words, you use one booster to launch the thing, and then you have different warheads going different places. This is a result of that.
Okay. So this fellow's argument was that presently, and this is a limitation on technology, it's easier now to defend a system it's easier now to create defenses against ABMs. In other words, an ABM system would try to knock out missiles, and it's easier to protect your missiles from an ABM system than it is to create a system, an ABM system that's perfect, that's it's very good. And with that possibility, it's easy to come up with new ideas to make more warheads to outfox an ABM system, which would be very crude compared to the offensive that can be created. And so the outcome of an ABM system would be to create more warheads, and sure, someone might be knocked out, you have that many more to deal with and that many more ABM systems to try and develop. You know, I agree.
Okay, that's a good objection. Let's consider it a couple ways. First, just on the morality of it, I think Christians have got to be opposed to what we're doing now. Okay, just on the sheer morality of holding the Russian people hostage when they haven't done anything. You know, they are tyrannized by their government, and they're also tyrannized and threatened by ours. We'll say, if you attack our people, then we'll attack your people. Now, that is overlooking the fact that in a just war, you do not make civilian populations a military target. All right. Now, in all wars, civilians have sometimes suffered as a consequence or byproduct of war. In other words, you can't clear everybody out. If the Japanese or the Germans build a munitions factory right smack in the middle of a city, and this is, and the munitions factory is a legitimate military target, and you attack it, and inadvertently, some civilians are killed because you can't get all the civilians out of the area before you attack. You're just not in that position. But your target is a military target, and civilians are inadvertently killed, then that's tragic, but not immoral. If you say, we are going to attack this hospital or this orphanage or this suburb, that is our target, and we're going to kill everybody in it, then you're no longer going after a legitimate military target. You are a terrorist. And just because you are the head of a respected government doesn't make you not a terrorist. Right? Holding people hostage in that way, making civilians a military target, is terrorism. Right? Now, so that's the first thing. The just on the morality of it, we have to abandon our current strategy. Now, the people that object to the Star Wars and that sort of thing also object to our current strategy. So they would agree with you on that. Say, yes, we've got to do something about our current strategy. The second thing is, there is no offensive weapon that has yet been devised by man that has not met with a defensive counterpart or something that will neutralize it. Doesn't matter what it is. All right? Whether you're talking about the crossbow or the longbow or the catapult or the guns, whatever you're talking about, there is an offensive capacity and a defensive capacity. Now, usually what is brought up, what is invented first, is the offensive weapon. And then people scramble for a while and they come up with something defensive. But until they come up with a defensive counterpart, they usually think it's the end of the world.
But always in the present, there's flux between the offensive weapon and the defensive countermeasure.
What do you mean by flux?
There's a lag between the time.
Yes, there's lag time.
And there will always be that, too, I would venture to say.
Yes, I would say there's always a counterpart and there's always lag time. But one of the things that the president has said, and I think we need to think about it more, is that we have no reason for assuming that we are at the end of the world because we've come up with nuclear weaponry. There is no reason that I can conceive of why we are not capable of coming up with weapons that are far worse or far more effective. And you see what I mean? Worse in the sense that they are harder to counter, and better in the sense that they are not as destructive. In other words, when blowing up, conquering another country by making the whole thing a radioactive wasteland, you know, that quietly glows in the dark, is not of any benefit to you. Right? When ancient kings and emperors conquered territory, it's because they wanted productive territory, whether it was agriculture or mines, or, you know, they wanted to rule over something that was worth ruling over. They don't want to rule over something that looks like the dark side of the moon. All right. Now, we've gotten into this position where that's what we're going to do to each other unless we do something, but there's no reason at all why the development of laser technology and particle beams and those sorts of things could make nuclear weapons obsolete. As obsolete as the blunderbuss. All right. Now, I admit that there's a lag time, but I think that that's something that we need to be aware of. Nuclear weapons are not exempt from this, from the passage of time, and people coming out with things that will neutralize them. We just, we've got no reason for saying that they are somehow above that process. Now, the other thing is the contradiction in the people who object to, for example, a Star Wars system. They say that's just not feasible. It won't work. And besides, the Russians will build one. Now think about that for a minute. If it won't work, why would they build one? In other words, they're saying, on the one hand, they're saying it won't work, and besides, since it's going to work so effectively, they're going to want to have one too. The Star Wars system, let me explain that in more detail. The Star Wars system is placing a bunch of defensive satellites in space, so that at any point in time, you will have satellites over the Soviet Union. All right? Now, these satellites will be capable of attacking and knocking out a ballistic missile system. And what would happen is when the Soviets launched their missiles, there'd be satellites over the Soviet Union that would just take them as they came into outer space to go from continent to continent, they would be taken out of commission. All right. Now, what Matt was alluding to earlier is obviously as soon as you put satellites there, people are going to get feverishly to work on anti-satellite weapons. All right. And you're going to have you will have ICBMs, ABMs, AABMs, anti-ballistic ASATs is the anti-satellite weapons.
And the U.S. is going to test one very soon.
Anti-satellite. Now, and then you come up with a question, well, if they attack, obviously, before they would want to launch an ICBM attack, they would want to take out your satellites. So if they, suppose they launch an attack on your satellites, is that an act of war? All right, in other words, do you immediately go to war when they attack your satellites, before they've attacked you? So you've got a lot of, there are a lot of complicated pros and cons and backs and forth in it, and it isn't easy, but I will say one thing. When the landscape begins to be littered by a lot of complexity, one of the things you always want to do is return to basic fundamentals. All right? And the fundamentals are these, basic principles. One fundamental is that strength, there are two ways to breed a war. Right? There are two ways to get into a war. One is to be strong and arrogant. Right? If you are strong and arrogant, you're going to be looking for a fight. Secondly, is to be weak and lily-livered. In other words, if you're strong and arrogant, you're going to get into a fight. And if you're weak, you're going to get into a fight. Okay, now that's a fundamental principle. People get into fights because they're not prepared to fight. Okay, the person who's strong and arrogant says, I can afford to attack this person. Why can I afford to attack him? Because he's not ready for me. He's not prepared. In other words, Hitler thought he could get away with it. He thought England would fold. Now, if it had not been for Winston Churchill, the United States did not get into that war until we were attacked directly by the Japanese. The war had been going for some time before we had anything to do with it. If it had not been for Churchill, and if it had not been for Hitler's underestimation of what the British were able to do, he'd probably still be here today, or his cohorts occupying all of Europe. Now, the reason he thought he could get away with it was because the West, the countries he was going to attack, were not ready for him. That's what bred the war. All right. Now, basically, if we agree that our current strategy of mutual assured destruction is unacceptable from a moral standpoint, I would say an evangelical Christian could say that. A total pacifist would say we ought to unilaterally disarm. Or throw all our bombs into the sea, regardless of what they do. We should not use weapons. We should not be armed. We should not be prepared to fight. We should just lay down our weapons, whether they do or not. And if they attack us, they attack us. All right? That's a principled pacifist. A quasi-pacifist, a person who doesn't want to go that extreme route, will probably advocate disarmament through mutual negotiation. In other words, negotiate treaties. The conservative, on the other hand, the conservative Christian who objects to MAD on a moral basis will say we need to change strategies. We need to change what we're doing, but we do not need to negotiate with the Soviets. Right, now, here's the difference between those two positions. What do you do? Let's say you negotiate a treaty that says we will not do this or that. And let's suppose that as you sign this paper and you don't do this or that, and then you discover that the other side is doing this and that anyway. Now the question comes up, what is this piece of paper called a treaty worth? I mean, who enforces it? Okay, it's either enforced by the honor of both sides, or by the strength. You see, it's either enforced by the honor of both sides or by the strength of the other side. Those are the only two options. And the strength of the other side is only going to keep the treaty enforced if that strength is there and you're willing to use it, which brings you back to the first point. How do you use your strength? What's your strategy for using it? What are you going to do about this? In other words, when the United States signs a fishing treaty with Canada, right, we've got every reason to believe that the terms of it will be met. All right? In other words, both sides are entering into this agreement honorably. And then negotiation about salmon fishing rights or negotiation about this, that, or the other thing is a perfectly acceptable thing to do with the Canadians. All right? Negotiating with a Hitler is an unacceptable thing to do unless you know what he's up to and you have the strength to counter what he's up to. In other words, the piece of paper has no teeth. It is of no value whatsoever unless you have the strength to make the treaty stick. If you don't have the strength to make the treaty stick because the other side is not honorable, then there's no sense in making it. All right? So you have to negotiate. When you negotiate with an untrustworthy party, you have to negotiate from a position of strength, not a position of weakness. Because if you negotiate from a position of weakness and they violate the treaty, there's nothing you can do. Are you with me on this? So where does that put us? One of the things that's tragic, again, going back to the Second World War, that war could have been avoided. It did not need to be fought. Britain could have negotiated with Hitler had they listened to Churchill years before and had been armed and ready. They weren't armed and ready, and when Chamberlain tried to negotiate with him, Hitler just took him to the cleaners. That's all that happened. And now what happens if you say, all right, we aren't going to do this. All right, we insult one. We said, we will have no ABM system. And the Soviets said, we aren't going to have an ABM system either. And then they start building an ABM system. Now what do you do? Nothing. There you are. Okay, now, that is why it is important for us to say, look, yes, negotiation is good, but not as an activity in itself. It depends on what you come up with and what you come up with and how you are going to enforce it if the other side reneges or does not keep it. Right before the election to the Senate, an intelligence report was submitted to the House of the Senate, I'm not sure which, detailing 11 major violations of existing treaties by the Soviets. In other words, fundamental violations.
Such as?
I'm not sure what the list of the 11 are. I know some of them. For example, the Soviets have built a huge ABM radar station.
Well, I don't know what's ABM for sure.
Well, that's what's said.
Well, I talked to a guy this morning that he was saying that it's a possibility that it is an ABM system.
Okay. I don't know enough about that to say. I accept what you're saying. Another thing that they do is they encrypt the telemetry. In other words, one of the ways you monitor verification of what's going on. I tell you what, if I could go outside the sub here and lay my Bible in the street, and a satellite could take a picture of this, you know, see it and identify it for what it is, an open book lying on the street from outer space. Okay, you can identify, you know, you can spot a pair of boots from outer space with the current abilities we have. Now, a lot of there are different ways to verify what's going on. One is on-site inspection, where people come and, like UN inspectors come and inspect what you have, which the Soviets don't have anything to do with. Another is to verify what they're doing through electronically monitoring the signals that govern their launches, their test launches, for example. Now, it is in violation of a treaty to encrypt your telemetry, that is to say, put it in code, so you can't, to garble the message, so you can't monitor what they're doing. Right? And the Soviets do that. When that sort of thing happens, you say, what do we do? How do we verify it? How do we follow up on it? How can we be certain that this is going on? Now, this is one of the things that's important to for a Christian to say is the objective is to keep us out of a war. That is not, it's not as though the pacifists are for peace and the other people are want to kill. Right? Now, that's how it's characterized. Someone who wants to beef up the defense budget is characterized as someone who wants to use these weapons rather than someone who wants to build them so that they will never be used. So what we have is two types of people, both of them advocating peace, one saying peace through negotiation, the other saying peace through strength. But the objective is peace. Now, Christians should be peacemakers. Jesus, blessed are the peacemakers, for they be called sons of God. Christians are in the business of making peace. They should start with their own relationship with God and their relationship with others. They should know what makes for peace between people with conflicts. And they should be influencing, thinking about how that can be translated into international affairs. How can we maintain peace and order? The only way that I know of historically to do that is through some type of strength. Now, some forms of strength I find thoroughly unchristian. An arrogant, nationalistic, we're better than everybody else, that type of strength I find morally objectionable. The type of strength that can blow up every man, woman, and child in the Soviet Union, I find objectionable. But the type of strength that is willing to defend your own people and counter, to whatever extent possible, whatever they want to attack you with, I don't find objectionable. And I would say that type of a strength is necessary in order to be able to negotiate with them at all. Okay, now one final point. This has to do with the Soviet Union in general. The Soviet Union's economy is simply a train wreck. They are on a collision course with disaster. They are funneling so much of their wealth into their militaristic adventurism, and the people are doing so poorly. In contrast, I don't think that they can keep it up. In other words, you'd say, well, we're going to do this. We'll build a system, then they'll build a system, then we'll build a system, and then they'll build a system. And people say, well, this is going to go on ad infinitum. I think they're neglecting the fact that I don't think it's possible for them to continue. In other words, I don't think they've got the capacity. All right. Now, again, if you notice what the president said in the debate, once we developed a defensive capacity, he said he wouldn't be at all adverse to giving that technology to the Soviets. If we're not going to attack them, then we don't mind them having, you know, spending money defending themselves. You know, let them have their defensive capacity, and we'll share it with them. And we'll negotiate something that says, when we develop this, we'll give it to you. There's a difference between saying, we'll develop an offensive weapon and then give it to you, because you could attack us with that, and we'd have no defense. But if I develop, for example, there are people out there with guns that could shoot at me, and I develop a bulletproof vest. Okay, I don't care if these murderers and robbers buy these vests that I developed to protect themselves from me, because I wasn't going to attack them anyway. Do you see what I mean? I don't mind sharing that kind of technology. But if I develop a gun and I wasn't going to use it on anybody, I was just going to target shoot, but someone else is a murderer, I don't want them to get the gun. So that's
if they get the vest, then they can figure out how to
use it. That's a possibility, and I think that if they figure out a way to use the vest as a shield, so that they can then pour more of an effort into an offensive capacity, that's a concern. But overall, I don't have an objection to them defending themselves. Now, what it boils down to is this. Christians are to be peacemakers. Christians, I don't think, should lend their support to any kind of terrorism, whether it's terrorism by our government or terrorism by another one. I see very little difference between threatening to blow up all the Israelis on the bus and threatening to blow up every kid in Leningrad. I don't see the difference between the two. Right? Now, one of the differences is because it seems so distant, but Christians have got to be able to translate these issues into the people concerns that they are. When again, on the submarine, I was part of the fire control team. And I was a quartermaster, and so we were in the navigation department, and we were part of the fire control team. And when we went to battle stations, we would be in this control room full of computers and blinking lights. That was battle stations. Now, someone in the Army, battle stations, they don't have battle stations, but when they're in a battle, they're in a trench and they're looking over, and they're over there and they're shooting at me, and I can see them. I'm in an actual shooting war where I can see or not see my enemy, and it's the same kind of war that people have been fighting for thousands of years. But when you are a technician working with computers, and you know everything lines up, and then you push this button, and then you hear a whoosh, it's removed from you. All right. Now, because it's removed, many times Christians don't think out the implications. Why is it wrong for this hijacker to threaten to kill people on the plane to get what he wants, and okay for us to threaten to kill people that don't have anything to do with it to get what we want? It's just not right. All right. So we must abandon that system, that strategy. And if we go the direction of negotiation, I don't trust the Soviets, and I think that's going to bring about a war. If we go the other way, an alternative strategy, then there are going to be bugs to work out, problems to work out, but I think that we've got to go that direction and work them out, because that's the only moral alternative I see that we can take as Christians.